Hello, I'm Darren Newman, and this is the Range of Reasonable Responses podcast. In this series, I've been delving into the employment law archives, looking at classic employment law cases from the past and trying to see what lessons they have for us today. But there's a bit of a change of tone for this podcast, because instead of looking at previous UK employment law cases, I'm not only going back in time, but also across the Atlantic to the origin story of indirect discrimination. That's the US Supreme Court's decision in Griggs against Duke Power Company from back in 1971. And I think what's prompted me to look at this case is that we recently had the decision of our own Supreme Court in Aesop against the Home Office, which was joined with Naim against the Ministry of Justice, where the Supreme Court was sorting out the whole concept of indirect discrimination. And it struck me that there are some interesting parallels between the Aesop case and Griggs. In Aesop, what we had was a test being applied by the civil service that you had to pass in order to get to the next level up on the career ladder. And when the civil service did an impact assessment, they found that BME, black and minority ethnic members of staff, were significantly less likely to pass that test and were therefore being excluded from promotion at a disproportionate rate. Now, there wasn't any evidence as to why that was, and one of the issues for the Supreme Court was whether it mattered that you didn't know why a particular group was less likely to pass the test. The Court of Appeal, in what was frankly an absolute car crash of a judgment, suggested that in order to claim indirect discrimination in a case like this, you have to show why the group as a whole was less likely to pass the test. And you also had to show why the individuals bringing a claim had failed the test, and then show that the two amounted to the same disadvantage. Now, the Supreme Court has basically scotched that and put the position back to what I think most employment lawyers would have always regarded the position as being, which is that if a claimant can show that the test causes a disproportionate disadvantage to people from a particular ethnic group, then that will be indirect discrimination unless the employer can show that it's a proportionate means of achieving a legitimate aim. Now, I'm not really going to go into the details of the Supreme Court's ruling. It's a really good decision, actually. It's very readable, so I recommend you have a look at it. There's also all sorts of commentary out there on exactly what the case is about and what it means. But I do want to look at this case of Griggs against Duke Power because I think it's got some interesting things to say about the way in which indirect discrimination operates. And there's an interesting, I think, compare and contrast exercise to do in relation to Aesop. Obviously, as a US case, it's not part of our law, so to that extent it doesn't necessarily have a practical impact. But I think it's interesting anyway, and it's my podcast. I said earlier that this is the origin story of indirect discrimination, and it really, literally is. We're used, when we think about equality law, to think about the influence of Europe. So we tend to think of the Equality Act as implementing our obligations under the European Treaty to comply with various equal treatment directives. And it's often the theme of the cases we look at that we're considering what the European Court of Justice has said and how we can give effect to that in our law. But this is a comparatively recent thing. It's not where our discrimination law comes from. The Sex Discrimination Act 1975 and the Race Relations Act 1976 weren't passed in order to comply with our European obligations. We did get an equal treatment directive soon afterwards, but it only dealt with sex, and the Race Discrimination Directive wasn't adopted until 2000. Back in the mid-70s, sex and race discrimination legislation were part of the programme of the Labour government, and that programme was led at the time by the Home Secretary Roy Jenkins, together with his special adviser, a barrister called Anthony Lester. He's now Lord Lester of Herne Hill. When they were putting the law together, the example they looked to was not Europe, but the US. And in particular, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which had been forced through by Lyndon Johnson after the Kennedy assassination. The concept of indirect discrimination that found its way into the Sex Discrimination Act and the Race Relations Act isn't based on anything in European law. They were basing this on the case of Griggs against Duke Power. So, the case was decided by the US Supreme Court on March 8, 1971. At that stage, Nixon is president, but the Watergate Hotel has yet to be burgled. That will happen in September later that year. The Vietnam War shows no signs of ending, but the tide is starting to turn against the United States. And the fight of the century takes place between Joe Frazier and Muhammad Ali in New York. They go 15 rounds and Joe Frazier wins on points. The US number one hit single is One Bad Apple by the Osmonds. Now, I'll play some of that later, but I warn you right now, it contains vocals from Little Jimmy Osmond, so listener discretion is advised. Our case is set at a power station, or power plant, as the Americans would call it, in North Carolina, one of the southern United States, and it's important to bear in mind the context in which this case is being decided. In 1971, it was only 10 years since North Carolina had started, in a quite limited way, to desegregate its schools. The story of the segregated South is a shocking one, and North Carolina was at the heart of it. In Greensboro, North Carolina, a series of sit-ins had led Woolworths, yes, that Woolworths, had led the company to desegregate its lunch counters as recently as 1960. The Woolworths store where the protest took place is now the site of a civil rights museum. So the issue of segregation, whether it comes to education or work, or even simply getting served in the cafeteria, was something that was highly controversial, highly contested in North Carolina and other southern states throughout the 1960s. And prior to the Civil Rights Act coming into force in 1965, Duke Power, which operated, and in fact it still does operate, though it's called Duke Energy now, a power plant about 60 miles north of Greensboro, had very deliberately and very openly segregated its workforce. There were five categories of worker at the power plant. The lowest paid group they simply referred to as labour. One up from that was coal handling. Then there was a general operations group, then a maintenance group, and then the laboratory and test group. African Americans prior to the Civil Rights Act were very deliberately only recruited into the labour pool, the lowest grade of employee, where the highest rate of pay was lower than the lowest rate of pay in any of the other groups. There was no prospect prior to the Civil Rights Act of any African American employee being promoted or transferred into one of the highest paid groups. But with the passage of the Civil Rights Act, that had to change. It was no longer lawful to segregate your workforce in that deliberate way. What the company then did, though, was to require anybody who was transferring from the Labour Department to one of the other higher paid groups to have graduated from high school. And anyone they were recruiting into one of those higher paid groups not only had to have graduation certificate from high school, but also had to pass two professionally prepared aptitude tests. One of those tests purported to be a general intelligence test, and the other was on mechanical comprehension. Neither test was specifically targeted at any aspect of the job, and it was generally accepted that the scores that you needed in order to pass those tests equated to roughly the national median for high school graduates. Now, at the time the case was launched, Duke Power had 95 employees at this particular power plant in North Carolina, and 14 of those employees were African Americans. Only one of them had the necessary qualification to get promoted into one of the other departments, and so 13 of those employees brought a claim alleging discrimination contrary to the Civil Rights Act. They were relying on Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. You write out the word title and then it's a V and two I's, so Roman numerals. And Title VII prohibits discrimination in the workplace, but it doesn't have a very detailed definition of what discrimination actually is. So this case was very much testing whether a requirement imposed by the employer, as in this case, which had a disproportionate impact on people of one particular race, could amount to discrimination under Title VII. Now, reading this case, you get the distinct suspicion, in fact, it seems glaringly obvious, that the employer had deliberately come up with an education level assessment that was designed to exclude African Americans. In North Carolina at that time, the differences between the educational achievements of African American children and white children were stark. The 1960 census showed that in North Carolina, 34% of white men had completed high school, and just 12% of African American men had completed high school. So when the employer instituted this test, they must have known what it was doing. Surely it knew that the effect of putting this test in place would be to exclude African American employees from the higher grades in the power station. But the case proceeded to the Supreme Court on the basis that there was no intention to discriminate behind what the employer was doing. The employer claimed that they genuinely just wanted to pick the best people for the job, and they thought these tests were an appropriate way of doing that. In fact, they pointed to various projects they had underway to try and help fund their lower paid employees through a high school diploma. It's obviously tempting to look at that and go, yeah, right, but fact is the case proceeds on the basis that there was no intention to discriminate. One big difference, though, between this case and the Essop case is that in ESOP it was declared to be a mystery why people from a BME background were less likely to pass the test. But when we come to Griggs against Duke Power, there's no mystery about it at all. Although the tests that were being applied purported to measure intelligence, as the Supreme Court says, basic intelligence must have the means of articulation to manifest itself fairly in the testing process. In other words, it can't be a pure intelligence test. It tests your ability to answer certain kinds of questions, deal with certain kinds of problems. And the educational background that you've had can give you a distinct advantage in passing that sort of test. And the Supreme Court recognised that because they were African American, the claimants had long received inferior education in segregated schools. That's why their graduation rate was lower. That's why their success rate in these tests was less good. What Congress had required, the Supreme Court said, by passing Title VII, was the removal of artificial, arbitrary, and unnecessary barriers to employment when those barriers operated to discriminate on the basis of race or other impermissible classifications, as they put it. We'd say protected characteristics now. So the Act outlawed not only overt discrimination, but also practices that were fair in form, but discriminatory in operation. And the touchstone, the Supreme Court said, was business necessity. If an employment practice which excluded African Americans could not be shown to be related to job performance, then that practice would be unlawful. And the evidence showed that white employees who had been recruited before there was any requirement for a high school diploma or to pass those particular tests were not performing in their job any less well than the people who had met those new tests. There's then a nice bit of American judicial rhetoric, which I'll read out if I may. I won't try and do an American accent though. The facts of this case demonstrate the inadequacy of broad and general testing devices, as well as the infirmity of using diplomas or degrees as fixed measures of capability. History is filled with examples of men and women who rendered highly effective performance without the conventional badges of accomplishment in terms of certificates, diplomas and degrees. Diplomas and tests are useful servants, and Congress has mandated the common sense proposition that they are not to become masters of reality. That's quite good, really, isn't it? Anyway, the discrimination case is upheld. Notice that the Supreme Court doesn't use the phrase indirect discrimination, but that's what we called it when we essentially took the principles in Griggs and turned them into statutory language in the Sex Discrimination Act and then the Race Relations Act. And that concept of indirect discrimination is subsequently picked up in European law. It finds its way into equality directives and ECJ case law. And until the Supreme Court's decision in ESOP and Naeem just recently, it had started to look as though the whole indirect discrimination case law was getting so bogged down in technicality that we were losing sight of that common sense proposition. That if you have a test that causes a particular disadvantage to one group because they're less likely to pass it, you have to demonstrate that the test is a reasonable one to apply. Luckily, Baroness Hale, in a particularly well-written decision, has pressed the reset button in indirect discrimination in the UK and restored that common sense view that we find in the US Supreme Court way back in 1971 in Griggs against Duke Power. Yeah. So that's our trip across the Atlantic. Do join me again for some more classic employment law cases. I promise we'll look at the UK next time. And in the meantime, if you like this sort of thing, you can subscribe to these podcasts on iTunes or subscribe by email on the website. You can also check out my written blog, which is A Range of Reasonable Responses, and you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Daz Newman. Thanks for listening. Someone else will come along and suck it to you again.